The following is a complimentary excerpt of this week's edition of the Friday Focus podcast by The Monk Debates. To access full-length editions of each and every episode, along with all kinds of great additional benefits and perks, become a donor to The Monk Debates. You can do that for as little as $25 a year, and you'll receive each and every year 50 Friday Focus episodes at full length. It's all available right now on our website in just a few simple clicks. www.themonkdebates.com. Look for the Friday Focus option in our navigation bar at the top right of the website. Make your donation and we will send you each and every Friday a link to listen to the full-length edition of this program. Thanks in advance for your generous contribution. Hello, welcome to the Friday Focus podcast. I'm Rudyard Griffiths, your host and moderator. Thank you for joining us each and every Friday for our in-depth conversations with Janice Gross Stein, the founding director of the Monk School of Global Affairs, internationally renowned scholar and author. We're going to go deep into, we hope, 3-4 stories, because again, another busy week to summarize, Janice. And let's start with what we see happening in Ukraine. And I wonder if you could help me, because I've had a bit of a, I don't know what it, I would call it, a crisis of conscience this week, a moment of real introspection. You know, on this program, I've been maybe, I don't know, some people might think overly concerned about the risks of escalation and willing to, in a sense, at all costs, avoid a conflict between NATO and Russia. But this week, Janice, looking at what's happening in Ukraine, the dismemberment of the power grid, attacks on hospitals, intentional or not, one just has a sense, Janice, you know, how can we stand by and let this go on? This has moved beyond simply war between two armies on a front line. It is now turned into a direct Russian attack on the entire civilian infrastructure of a country that is inhabited by millions of people heading into the winter.
I agree with you, Roger. This is brutality at a level that, frankly, we've not seen in Europe since World War II. We've seen in other parts of the world, but we have not seen in Europe. And let's be really clear, this is a war crime and a crime against humanity. When you deliberately, there's no question they are deliberately targeting civilian infrastructure. They want to knock out the power grid to plunge Ukrainians into darkness. I mean, we have horrific stories coming out of surgeons operating with, while nurses are holding flashlights. This is an attempt just to break the will of the Ukrainians and force Zelensky to the table. And it is frankly god awful to watch. It is just god awful to watch. I don't think there's anybody who can look at this and, no matter what Russia's objectives are, justify this behavior. If we do, I agree with you, we are leaving behind 70 years, frankly, of progress. We are just tossing it in the ash can of history. What do I know from my work as a political scientist? I know two things. It does not work. Doing this to a civilian population does not work. We know it from when Hitler did it to the Brits in the Blitz. We have innumerable examples. Paradoxically, the worse the hardship, the more people rally behind their leader. And that's what we're seeing with Ukraine. So the strategy will not work. But what it does do is leave a permanently enraged an embittered population. You know, at the Monk School, Rudyard, we have a group of Ukrainian students that we made special efforts to bring from Ukraine, and they're here with us for the year so that they don't lose their year. And I met with them last week, and the anger, the rage these people feel about what is being done to their country. Russia is laying the seeds. It is sowing the seeds on its own border of a level of fury and a desire for revenge, which I believe will haunt Russia for decades.
Janice, has the moral imperative for us, for NATO, for Canada, for the West now changed? I mean, do we need to acknowledge that, as you say, we're seeing the repeat, in a sense, of horrors of the Second World War that we said would never be repeated? Putin has used the threat of his nuclear arsenal as a cloak, a cover, in a sense, a virtual iron curtain, which he has, slammed down between the borders of Ukraine and NATO and said, you shall not intervene. But at what point, Janice, do we just simply sit by and watch this? I mean, there was just this tragic story of this baby that survived for just maybe 2 hours, was killed in the delivery room as its mother was taken away, kind of traumatized. And it's one story, but it just speaks to the absolute kind of horror of what's going on there. And I don't know, I'm at a point, Janice, a bit of an inflection point. I would say, what if we said, okay, it's time for NATO to go into Ukraine defensively. We are not going to go in with offensive weapons, but we are going to deploy troops in the western half of the country, not up against the front line, but in the western half of the country with the latest air defense systems operated by Western troops who will also be on the ground to provide humanitarian assistance to the people of Ukraine. And let's start thinking about, Putin, let's call your bluff here, because you have no conventional army. You have no ability at this point to threaten NATO. And if you do, you are, in a sense, calling down potentially the destruction of your regime. I mean, have we come to a point now, Janice, where we have to move aside from fearing this Voldemort, ensconced in the Kremlin, and act with some sense of urgency here as the people of Ukraine face not only electricity, a collapse of their entire water processing and treatment system in Kiev?
Yeah, yeah. This is this is the roughest moment for Kyiv since this war began, because there's no clean water, there's no electricity. Just think about that in a large city. And one third of the population of Ukraine is either out of the country or internally displaced. It's almost unimaginable. So what should NATO do now? And at the Halifax Security Forum, where I was last week, Rudyard, the feelings you gave voice to were, I think, were the mood of everybody in the room. Fury, do more, do not give in to nuclear blackmail. And that came from military people as well as civilian people. We are at the watershed. So what does a watershed moment look like here? I think short of deployment of troops, there is still much more that we can do. All right. So one, actually move much faster than everybody is moving to deploy anti-aircraft missile systems, which will knock out. You will never get 100%. And the Ukrainians are doing a great job. They are, frankly, now knocking out two-thirds of the missiles that are coming at them. But one-third are getting through. Deploy inside Ukraine at a much faster basis, anti-aircraft missile systems, but without the troops, just to still preserve that thin line. Second thing, believe it or not, is how do you, and it's complementary, how do you help Ukrainians get through this nightmare period without power and electricity? So here's where the Ukrainians have been geniuses all the way along. It's the 1,000 points of light on the ground, right? You flood Ukraine with generators and with systems that are, and you can distribute them locally. And I don't know if you noticed, but Zelensky made a speech yesterday in which he said virtually every two blocks, there will be a heating center where you can charge your phones and electricity and get food and get warm and come and stay. And that's his strategy. And that has worked for Ukraine every time. Push the decision-making way down, decentralize the response.
What is the argument against NATO troops in a defensive capacity operating defensive missile systems, in a sense, creating a bit of a human shield here? Because Putin would have to understand that, one errant missile that strikes a a battalion or platoon of NATO soldiers would then really truly risk and risk an escalation. Like, I'm just wondering, have we reached the point here where, you know, again, you know, mass graves discovered in Kherson, multiple mass graves. Okay, like at what point do you act on the basis of what would we tolerate? Would we tolerate the direct targeting of hospitals? Say, let's say
that's happening. That's happening.
Yeah, but let's say in a very conscious methodological way, they start missiling the entire hospital system of Ukraine. Is that a red line for us? What is a red line? Now we've drawn these these red lines way at the end of the continuum, which are the use of biological and chemical weapons and the use of a tactical nuclear weapon.
Yeah.
This starts to feel like, to me, like Putin is playing with us. He's now pushed the yardstick so far out on one end that he's now allowed to do anything, short of those three kind of horsemen of the apocalypse.
Well, this is a dilemma of fighting a nuclear power, right? And it's probably we're going to see more of this in the world, not less, because we Iran is now moving ahead at a very quick pace to develop its nuclear weapon. So the issue is, what difference would NATO troops make in Western Ukraine to the scenario you just painted, Rudyard? Probably not a lot, because Russia would still be able to target the whole of Eastern Ukraine. It's probably still would be able to target Kyiv. It's not clear that it would make a critical difference if you restricted it to Western Ukraine. And it puts the ball, as you say, then in Putin's corner. What if he then attacks Western troops in NATO? What's the next step? So this is the dilemma. The first step is always easy. That's easy. But what good generals are paid for is to ask, what happens after the next step? So let's follow your scenario that a missile, kills Polish troops, Estonian troops, U.S. troops that are deployed in Western Ukraine. What's the response? Is it to kill Russian troops? Where? In Crimea? In Donetsk? In the Donbass? And then what happens next? What do the Russians do after that? And that's that horrible ladder of escalation that you and I have been talking about, which is chilling, frankly, because Russia has put in such a lousy conventional performance. Its army is so degraded. What does it have left? Two things. These dumb missiles, because they're not smart, that are crippling Ukraine, and unconventional weapons. So thinking ourselves down that road, three or four steps, it puts us in a nightmare scenario.
I agree, but that is the deterrence that he is benefiting from, having these, weapons of Sauron to invoke Lord of the Rings. And he has a lot of characteristics that
Rudyard, here's the sense
of that tree. But just to finish this point, if we accept that deterrence, then we're accepting right now the forced deportation of women, men, and children from Ukraine into Russia. We're accepting in all the cities that seem to be retaken from the Russians, mass graves where people have been shot with their hands tied behind their backs in the dozens, in some cases, possibly the hundreds. We're talking about allowing him to completely degrade the entire civic infrastructure of a country of, tens of millions of people, all the while Russia suffers, in a sense, nothing on its territory. So the complete asymmetry of this, again, has to speak to some moral cause here, where you just allow this 850-pound, wounded gorilla to maul, the child that falls into the zoo, enclosure. I think we're getting to a point now, Janice, where we have to start thinking about all this concern about deterrence and the escalatory ladder. That's how Putin wants us to think. And that's his weapon. It's a psychological weapon. And I don't know if we can just go on and on and on accepting the weight of that weapon on our own conscience, the smothering of our own moral imperative to act against what is clearly one of the great injustices of our generation.
This is the asymmetry between those in the world who have nuclear weapons, some 9-10 countries, depending on how you count, and those who don't. There is an asymmetry. And it gives them exactly the leverage. You know, nuclear weapons work as long as you don't use them, Roger. As soon as you use them, it's all over. You are a huge loser. So is everybody else. But they work, contrary to what a lot of people say. They work because non-nuclear powers or other nuclear powers are not willing to test the logic that you just put on the table. So they are able to operate under a threshold, and it is up to NATO to devise solutions below that threshold, shove those anti-aircraft missiles into Ukraine as fast as you can. I think there are solutions to the electricity and power problem. There really are, but it requires a kind of mobilization of everybody that we haven't seen yet, and that NATO countries should lead and move and transfer literally hundreds of thousands of generators, private generators, into that country at the local level to obviate the worst of this. Mm-hmm. Is this going to stop Russia's capacity to slaughter Ukrainians, which is what we're... No, it's not. So who's the decision maker here, Reggie? It's, in a sense, it's Zelensky, right? And this is... And we saw something this weekend, which... It slipped under the radar because of everything else that was going on. Mark Milley, the chairman of the Joint Chiefs in the United States, floated a trial balloon. It is time to stop. And then the United States made an offer to Russia and to Ukraine for ceasefire with a 7-year deal. The Russians get to keep Crimea, but there'll be a referendum in 7 years. And the Ukrainians stay out of NATO, but there'll be a referendum in 7 years. Turned down cold by both sides in a minute. Neither side is willing to contemplate the kind of political sacrifice that would be necessary to even get to a ceasefire right now. So I reluctantly come down on the side. We all have to remember that Russia has nuclear weapons. The worse it is doing, the greater the probability that something happens. We saw how hair trigger this is when that errant missile, which was Ukrainian, flew over into Poland, and the NATO command sprang into action. Just imagine if it had been a Russian missile, Rudyard. Nothing changes the fact that this is still a serious risk of escalation, and that Putin holds the whip hand as long as he can threaten to use these weapons.
Well, You've run the clock out on me successfully. We got to take a break. We'll be back on the other side. Thanks for listening to this excerpt of the Friday Focus podcast. To get full-length editions of each and every episode of this program, simply go to our website, www.themonkdebates.com. Click on the Friday Focus tab in our navigation on the top right of the site. Make a donation as little as $25 a year or 50 cents an episode, and we'll send you not only the full-length editions of each and every Friday Focus podcast, but all kinds of special offers, perks, access to events, and additional content. Again, you can do that right now by becoming a donor to the Monk Debates at www.monkdebates.com.